You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @PolicyPodcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal Monetary Policy here at Brookings. Mark's going to speak first. I'll come up there. I'm very pleased to. I need a copy of the book. I had one. Oh, here it is. I'm very pleased today to welcome the authors of this new book, Sarah Binder and Mark Spindell. Sarah is a senior fellow here at Brookings and is also a professor of political science at George Washington University. She's made a career out of studying Congress, which is somewhere between, I must say, either frustrating or interesting, depending on your political persuasion. She's written about gridlock and filibuster. And she and Mark, who's the founder of a hedge fund in town called Potomac River Capital, have taken a whack at something that I think is really important. I think there's a lot of shorthand that comes with discussing what the Federal Reserve is. And somehow in any discussion of the Federal Reserve, the word independent always appears. But I think the definition is sometimes not completely clear. Some people talk about it being independent within the government. Other people talk about the virtues of independence, maybe being questioned now that we're in an era of low inflation. There are questions about what aspects of the Fed's responsibilities, monetary versus regulatory, should they be independent of the political system? Questions about is it really so wrong if the Treasury and the Fed coordinate on something, particularly at a time of low interest rates and quantitative easing? So these are all really big questions. And what Mark and Sarah have done successfully, I think, is take us back to the roots of the Federal Reserve in 1913. It's basically a political history of the relationship between the Fed and the Congress. And so what we're going to do is Mark is going to speak some about the book, and then Mark is going to take a seat in the audience, but he'll participate in a panel discussion that will be moderated by Ilan Mui from CNBC. We have two former Fed governors, Randy Krosner and Mark and Larry Meyer, and then Sarah Binder will join him up on stage. So to start, I'd like to welcome Mark Spindell to the stage.
p.m., September 29th, 2008. Who remembers where they were? Anybody? When I called my friend, Sarah Binder, my neighbor, and conveniently an expert on Congress, which had at that exact moment torpedoed George W. Bush's TARP bill, bond markets were in disarray. The economy was in disarray. The Fed had supported this legislative effort, and for sure, Congress was in disarray. Never let a crisis go to waste. One could never have known that our conversation would lead to this. And like the Congress and the Fed for that matter, Sarah and I have accumulated many debts along the way. This afternoon is a perfect example. And as befits a project that attempts to break down silos, we had a lot of help and guidance from a range of colleagues, policymakers, staffers, journalists, peers, and other Fed watchers. Indeed, we're very grateful to Brookings and the Hutchins Center, to David Wessel and his colleagues for supporting our work today and their general focus on monetary politics. To Randy and Larry, who I have known professionally for some time and have been learning from for even longer. Especially Larry, whose pre-Fed, Fed, and post-Fed insights have always been a vital component of how we think about politics and policy shaping markets and the economy. Sarah and I are incredibly grateful to have CNBC's Ilan Mui here today. Thank you, Ilan, for your participation from this side of the screen. And finally, just before I kick off, what we mean by the myth, thank you to Sarah. Ours is a unique collaboration, academic and practitioner. To be sure, the protagonists in our story influence markets and the economy and are influenced by them. We hope our collaboration helps shed some new light on how Congress governs the Fed. The myth of independence. our title gives it away. Conventional wisdom endorses a deeply entrenched notion of Fed independence. Generally, people assume the Fed is an independent central bank within the government. Congress creates the Fed, sets its goals, and insulates itself from inflationary temptation. People assume the Fed has instrument independence. And while you'd never know it from the recent Fed chair sweepstakes, structural features, extraordinary long terms for governors, staggered tenor for the chair, public-private partnership, Federal Reserve, are supposed to ensure their autonomy. And yes, conventional wisdom also pegs the elemental 1951 accord as the source of modern Fed independence. These are common claims made by central bankers and members of Congress, among others. We find this conventional wisdom mostly myth. And today we want to try and convince you that Congress and the Fed are better thought of as interdependent institutions. The Fed's perspective is clear. Congress is our boss. Precisely what Ben Bernanke told Kate Davidson when she asked him if he had any advice for incoming Fed Chair Yellen. Why? Because Congress always retains the power to reopen and revise the Federal Reserve Act. In the book, we review repeated episodes over the Fed's history of legislative efforts to shape monetary policy, at least indirectly, by shaping the governance and structure of the Fed. Why is that important? Because the Fed's power is contingent on securing exactly this kind of political support. And that political support from Congress is contingent on the Fed's stewardship of the economy. If Fed autonomy is conditional on support from Congress, what type of independence is that? And certainly Congress depends on the Fed. Imagine these 535 lawmakers setting interest rates. Of course, it's more than that. Members of Congress are motivated both by making good public policy and, of course, getting reelected. And so they need someone to blame when the economy sours. Who better than the almighty Federal Reserve? Hardly frozen in time, legislative attention to the Fed is countercyclical, rising with inflation or unemployment and waning as the economy recovers, suggesting again the conventional notion of independence is largely conditional. There's a nice chart in chapter 2, page 35, for those following along. Attention matters. Revisions or threats to revise the Act signal congressional dissatisfaction, and over the past century have dramatically altered our central bank. Now, of course, monetary policy is not made in isolation. The economy needs a healthy mix of monetary policy from the Fed and fiscal policy from Congress, another element of interdependence. And Congress empowers the Fed as the supreme financial regulator. Interdependence embodies more than monetary policy. But independence plus accountability just doesn't capture the political risks inherent in their relationship, which is precisely why we care so much about interdependence. The relationship between Congress and the Fed reveals a recurring cycle of crisis, blame, and reform. And we see this over the Fed's 100-year history. Crisis comes, Congress blames the Fed, reopens the act, sometimes empowering it, sometimes clipping its wings, often demanding more transparency, and D, usually all of the above. Exhibit A, Dodd-Frank, gave the Fed soup and reg power over systemically important financial institutions, limited lender of last resort power, imposed more transparency, particularly on emergency lending, and imposed more oversight, created a vice chair for supervision. A nice feature of this cycle, it solves a puzzle for us. Why, when the Fed fails to prevent a crisis, such as it did in 2007 and 8, does Congress react by giving the Fed even more power? How can you blame someone and then give them more responsibility? Well, the more responsibility the Fed has, and the more concentrated the power is in the hands of the Washington-based Board of Governors, the easier it is for Congress to turn and blame them when things go wrong. In 1964, testifying before Congress at the Fed's half-century celebration, then-Chairman William McChesney Martin observed, quote, "Now we do bear the slings and arrows of the public. You are in the position of being able to blame us if it goes wrong. We are certainly not asking for your applause if it goes right. But I think we will bear the opprobrium of the people if things go wrong, and we have to. This is part of our responsibility. Unquote. Absorbing blame. That's what they're there for. And Congress. Congress makes more threats as the economy falters. Classic blame-avoiding behavior. When we examine legislative attention to that Fed, to the Fed in that chart on page 35, a very clear pattern emerges. Congressional behavior is reactive and countercyclical. They are acutely aware of the Fed's impact on the economy. When the economy is sailing along, Congress takes all the credit and leaves the Fed alone. And when unemployment rises, with more people out of work, legislators blame the Fed and threaten it with reform. Put simply, in bad economic times, lawmakers try to deflect blame back to the Fed. So before I turn this over to the panel, we did want to see if there's evidence that legislative action or threats can check the power and independence of the Federal Reserve. We touch on many in the book, but I just want to focus on one contemporary issue this afternoon. And a caveat. Exploring what the Fed would have done in the absence of congressional threats or action, the counterfactuals are hard to find. Economic theory tells us that central bankers have the autonomy to choose monetary tools. But that theory doesn't square very well with the Fed's effort to adopt an inflation target, a tool used by many central banks around the world. The idea is that by setting a numeric target, you can help set expectations about future monetary policy. Bernanke started advocating for an inflation target when he joined the board in 2002. But there's a political problem. The Fed has a dual mandate, jobs and inflation. And a target for inflation only covers half that mandate. Bernanke, the central banker most commonly associated with inflation targeting, knew that putting a target in place required the consent of Congress. You see this in transcripts of FOMC debates before the crisis and after. Here's Don Cohn in December 2008. Quote, having an inflation target won't have any effect if it is repudiated by the Congress. Unquote. It comes up in Bernanke's memoir. He initially approached Barney Frank about scaffolding the target. The powerful chairman of the House Financial Services Committee pushed back, arguing that emphasizing one side of the inflation-employment duality, especially during a recession, sent the wrong signal. Ultimately, it took Bernanke almost 10 years to convince his boss. Sensitive to that pushback, the target needed explicit permission from Congress to be announced. More recently, there's been talk from current and former FOMC members about raising the target. Let me interrupt my talk to see what the boss had to say.
In a recent press conference, some interpreted comments that you made to indicate that you were open to an increase in the inflation target. Are you pursuing an increase in the inflation target? Are other members of the FOMC, is this a matter of discussion within the FOMC to increase the 2% inflation target?
It is not. We reaffirmed our 2% inflation target in January. We are very focused on trying to achieve our 2% inflation target, and it is not a subject of discussion.
Thank you. I will take no for an answer.
So when there are calls for the Fed, and in important cases by the Fed, to increase their inflation target, in this case, Republicans in Congress push back against any such change. Don't do anything without talking to us. Conventional wisdom suggests the Fed claims independence, but clearly it's acutely sensitive to the need to secure political support for its policy choices. One might also ask what a higher inflation target would accomplish in an environment where the Fed has failed to hit its current 2% goal. We'd probably not be having a debate about a December rate hike if the target were higher. This is what interdependence looks like. Let me stop. We are especially privileged to have Larry and Randy, two former members of the board, here today, and I'm going to turn the afternoon over to our panel. As such, let me reintroduce Ilan Mui, our moderator. Ilan is a reporter for CNBC, where she focuses primarily on economic and regulatory policy. Can I just say monetary politics? Her background in print journalism encompasses 15 years at the Washington Post, where she covered, among other topics, the Federal Reserve. I met her about 5 years ago when she first picked up the Fed beat. Her insightful reporting and engaging manner has always brought an important perspective for Sarah and me. We are privileged to have her and her panelists here today to help us explore the myth of independence. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mark, for that kind introduction, and thank you as well to Brookings and to the Hutchins Center for hosting this discussion today. It is my honor to introduce your panelists to you. I'll start right here to my left, Larry Meyer. He is president of Monetary Policy Analytics, Inc., and he served on the Fed's Board of Governors from 1996 to 2002. Sarah Binder is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. She's also a professor of political science at George Washington University, and she specializes in Congress and legislative politics. And over there on the end is Randy Krosner. He is the Norman R. Bobbins Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, and he served on the Fed's board from 2006 to 2009. Thank you all for being here. So one thing that I thought was so interesting out of Mark and Sarah's book was this idea that political and congressional attention to the Fed is countercyclical. And we have here, actually on opposite sides of the podium, two former Fed governors who served at essentially opposing ends of a business cycle. So Larry, I'd like to start with you. You served at a time of relative prosperity and stability. Did Congress leave you alone and let you do what you wanted?
Well, so the first thing I disagree with is the cover and the title. It's not a myth.
Just a few things.
No, it's a very interesting book. But let me talk about what's wrong with it, because that's more fun. But most of it is right. It's just the cover, the last sentence, and one or two other sentences. But the narrative is great. It just needs a new title. So it's good to be here with Mark, an old friend, Sarah, a new friend, and of course Randy and Ilan. So let me start out and tell you what I want to do. I'm going to do three things, but hardly anything of the third, because that's what's right. And more interesting is what's wrong and why I think it's wrong. So I want to start with first what I think is wrong, second, why I think they got it wrong, and I'll very briefly tell you why I still really like the book. So, why the statements here are the cover and the very last page, 240. Let me see if I can find 240. Very last sentence. Okay. I can't read with my glasses on. Okay. At best, the Federal Reserve earns partial and contingent independence from Congress, and thus we conclude barely any independence at all. Wow. Wow. You know, I never thought I was a tool of Congress. I never would have accepted that position if I thought it was going to be a tool of Congress. And I was never a tool of Congress. You could see how I testified, and you'll know that. There's another sentence in here that I think is particularly good. And here they say, from atop Capitol Hill, Congress depends on the Fed both to steer the economy and absorb public blame. Well, now that's right. The first part is independence. They're there to steer the economy without political interference. And the last is it's the nature of politics, it's the nature of the game, and it's Congress's privilege since they put the Fed into existence and they can change it anytime they want. So Why'd they get it wrong? They never correctly identified what independence means. They never talked about goal versus instrument independence until page 225. Too late. Damage done. So let me explain what happened here. First, they say the Fed does not have goal independence. Now, remember, central banks around the world, none of them have goal independence. Legislatures have set the goals in what they think is the public interest. Okay, that's always the way it is. No central bank has goal independence. What independence means in the context of central banking is instrument or operational independence, which means having the right to adjust their instruments to achieve their congressional mandate without political interference. So that's what we want to see. How is policy different because of what Congress said or did? Now, the goal independence problem is they say that they don't have goal independence and therefore they're not independent. Okay, that's completely wrong. But they go for the jugular when they say that they don't even have instrument independence. And Mark set me up very nicely, thank you, by talking about their key story about why they don't have instrument independence. And that's because they had to consult with Congress and get a buy-in from Congress before they implemented an explicit numerical inflation objective. Now remember, it took 65 years for Congress to impose on the Fed a mandate, inartfully described as maximum employment and price stability, but it was there. Now, they never defined either, and particularly price stability. And so central banks around the world, by the time the Fed got around to having an explicit objective in 2012, they were basically the last. They were late in the game. Everybody else had explicit inflation objectives. So the story is they say an inflation objective is an instrument. It is not an instrument. It is a specification in numerical terms of an objective. So this is a really kind of, how do you balance this? What's the role of Congress? What's the role of the Fed? And I think that's kind of was a tension. And the Fed, we had talked about this. We couldn't get it done. I couldn't get it done. Others who wanted it with me couldn't get it done. But we all knew that the Fed was going to have to consult with Congress, bring them along, because this was a politically contentious issue. But independence is using the funds rate balance sheet policy to achieve a 2% objective or to achieve what price stability is. Now, I'm not surprised Congress might say, I told you price stability. Somebody said during the debate that's zero. Well, we had that debate the first meeting I was there. Greenspan said it was zero. Okay. But the rest of us decided it was 2%. Okay. But we're not allowed to talk about it. Okay. So now, what do they get right? I said almost the narrative. There are only a few sentences in here that I would pick out, and that discussion of the inflation objective. What they get right is the story that this is a story, and as I say in chapter 2, the title, the blame game. That's what it's about. That's the nature of politics, okay? Blaming the Fed when something goes wrong. But it is more than that, as Sarah and Mark said. It's that the Fed has to be very careful to maintain relationships with Congress to protect their independence, because the best thing is to get it right, okay? If Congress doesn't think you get it right, then you have to rely on the political capital that you've built up in those personal relationships that Ben was very good at doing, and I'm sure Chair Yellen is as well. So that's why the Fed has maintained its independence, because they recognize every chairman comes into that position and knows one of his core responsibilities is to interact with Congress, build relationships that you'll need to fall back upon to protect the independence of the institution.
But Larry, doesn't that statement right there support the thesis of Sarah and Mark's book and the interdependence between the Fed and Congress?
No, I don't think so. So tell me what decision the Fed made since 1977, because I'm not a historian, I don't go back. What decision that they made with respect to the funds rate balance sheet policy was influenced by Congress?
Sarah, I think this is a good time to bring you in.
Okay. Well, let me just quickly echo Mark's thank you. And you can tell we had a lot of feedback along the way and exemplified here, which is really awesome that people are engaging and challenging the argument. I should say it's not a book I could have written by myself, and it's a much better book for having written it with Mark. So let me step back and then answer the direct question. I would suggest there may be a difference between, in Larry's terms, political interference with the Fed and political influence on the Fed, and the distinction may be worth probing out a little bit more. I would also suggest I'm not so sure that Congress neatly recognizes the distinction that central bankers clearly recognize between goals, dependence on the legislature, and instrument independence. I'm not so sure from our reading of congressional history that Congress sees that distinction. We see it throughout the ways in which Congress leans on and reshapes the Fed, whether it's the pushing back on the inflation target, whether it's imposition of transparency requirements over time, which every single time the Fed has fought because it infringed on their ability to pursue policy the way they wanted to. And of course, along the way, reading the FOMC transcripts, and again, we're not obviously in the room where happens, so to say. And so we are dependent on transcripts for a long period, but not the recent period. And you pick up constant reflections on political risk, political cost. What are the costs we're going to face if we push ahead? Just one example, and I think it strikes as a sort of iconic, right? What's the classic example of Fed independence? It's Paul Volcker in the early 1980s really combating stagflation. But when you open up the transcripts and read what they're saying, it's such things as Volcker in 1981. If we get this one wrong, we are going to have legislation next year without a doubt. We may get it anyway. It's a matter of judgment as to how that might come out and where the risks are, but I think we know where the risks are. Right? Discussions about when are we going to stop hiking rates? When are we going to ease policy? That there is constant discussion in the FOMC about the political costs. How long can we do this before we lose political support? And so there are other examples here, but I think we both, Mark and I both appreciate the importance of being very clear, as Larry had said, about being sure where we're drawing lines between instruments and goals. But.
So Sarah and Mark talk in the book about that cycle of crisis, blame, and reform. Randy, you were lucky enough to serve during all three of those things.
Yes.
Tell us what that was like.
So thank you. I'm delighted to be here to be commenting on this book, and I think this is an issue that doesn't get as much systematic attention as it deserves. I think the distinction that Larry drew is a very important one. I'll come back to that in a bit. I'll give some anecdotes from that period, because it's obviously one in 2008 where we were doing a lot of things that the Fed had not done before. We were using the so-called Section 13(3) powers, which, as Sarah and Mark talk about in the book, when the Fed did not respond in the early 1930s to the crisis, because the first line of the Federal Reserve Act is to provide a more elastic currency. There had been a private clearinghouse system that did that, and it was the judgment that it had failed in the Panic of 1907, and so we created a government organization to do that, because England had had the old lady of Threadneedle Street since 1694, et cetera, et cetera. The Fed didn't act when it should have, and then the Federal Reserve Act was amended to give these specific powers. In the term from the Act is unusual and exigent circumstances, and then outline what broadly what could be done in those unusual and exigent circumstances. And so we were very mindful of that during that that time period. We worked very closely with the legal staff to understand, well, what can we do? Because there was very little precedent for what unusual and exigent circumstances were. There's a very nice, it's a very high-minded phrase, but exactly what is pressing enough and what is unusual enough to allow the Fed to act. Then there was a description after that of the things that the Fed could do, what would or wouldn't be within that rubric. Remember, this legislation was passed in the 1930s, so the kind of institutions and instruments and markets that we have today are not exactly the same as in the 1930s, so we had to make what would be a reasonable interpretation of that. But we were certainly very mindful of using the powers that we had, but not going beyond the powers that we had. And I think, although certainly the Fed, as Sarah and Mark point out, came in for a lot of blame for, you know, why didn't you see this, why didn't you do something, there was very little response from Congress that you went beyond your powers. You may have used powers in ways that we didn't like, but it wasn't that the powers that you went beyond those powers. We were certainly very mindful of that whenever we were thinking about the 14 different programs that we had come up with in 2008, 2009 for providing support in whether it was to primary dealers, whether it was in particular markets in areas that we had never done before. So I think Sarah and Mark are right. We were extremely mindful of that. We wanted to make sure that we were acting within the powers that Congress had given us, because we were aware that if we went far beyond that, there would be we were worried that future Feds would not have these powers to be able to respond to a crisis. And of course, being at University of Chicago, I'm very much influenced by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz's view of the 1930s, which basically said that the Depression became the Great Depression because the Fed did not act. I think there's a broad, I think it's not just University of Chicago economists, but most people would agree with that. Certainly with three of the five of us on the board at the time who had been students of the 1930s, we were not going to make the same mistakes that the Fed made of inaction. Obviously, there's still lots of debates about whether we did the right things or not, but we were going to use the powers that we had within the what our interpretation of the law was. And as I said, I don't think Congress responded with, you went beyond your powers. I think they responded with, we didn't like the way you used those powers, and so we wanted to reform some of those. There was much more public pressure on the Fed, exactly as these guys say, in downturn times. And of course, in extremis in the in 2008, 2009. And that's, so I often describe this as the Fed goes from being front page of the business section in general newspapers, being the front page of the newspaper not just in the business section, but the front page of the newspaper. It was always on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, but that's sort of a more specialized publication, but in general ones. And that, of course, gets, there's a lot more attention that's being paid to everything that the Fed does. Aficionados knew how powerful the Fed was. And there were some members of Congress who were really, were kind of a Fed aficionados and knew that. But it was really only in 2008, 2009, when the Fed's balance sheet went from $800 billion to $2.4 trillion like that, where we were exercising our emergency powers, that people went suddenly, wow, this institution has a lot of power that we didn't fully realize. Because, of course, Congress would find a great deal of, it would take a long time for them to legislate to be able to spend $1.5 trillion. This was done very, very quickly in response to the crisis, exactly as I think both in the spirit and substance of those amendments to the Federal Reserve Act in the 1930s had given the Fed the right to do. But that certainly changed the dynamic, because there was a much broader group of people who were commenting on the Fed in a more detailed way. As these guys point out, and always in downturns, the Fed will be blamed, but there was much more of a focus. Both because of the blame game that they talk about, it was a much more intense downturn. So if people, of course, wanted to focus on someone else rather than them for having for the problems, but also just because the Fed became a much more public institution in the sense of much more public discussion of it, it became much, much more intense. But I was happy that that I don't think that Congress, although obviously Dodd-Frank reformed Congress's powers, giving some powers and taking other powers away, they didn't feel that we had gone beyond the powers that had been given us, even though they in some cases thought they didn't like the way in which we exercised them.
You bring up an interesting point, which is that in the past decade or so, the Fed has become a much more public-facing institution. To what degree does the Fed's political support depend on public support? I think you guys quote in your book that famous stat about the Fed being less popular than the IRS or something like that. And how important is it for the Fed to shore up the public support in the ultimate goal of building that political support?
Well, I think that certainly is important. I mean, you can see during the financial crisis, and as is pointed out in the book, Ben Bernanke, who is not, there's some people who love to be in the limelight and love to be up on stage. Ben, I don't think Ben may be here in the audience since he's here at Brookings. He should be able to speak for himself. But that's not the Ben that I know. But Ben decided to go do town halls, do 60 Minutes, not something that sitting central bank governors typically do, because it was seen as incredibly important to try to articulate what we were doing and why. Because it was extremely unusual what we were doing. We're in unusual and exigent circumstances. We're exercising these powers that really had never been systematically used before. People were very concerned and confused, whether it's Congress or public, and for good reason. This was a very unusual time. And so it was felt that not just speaking with members of Congress and with Senator Dodd Chairman Frank and Chairman Dodd, but a broader public, and that was an important conduit. So there were multiple points of support, and I think it was all done through trying to be trying to articulate what we were doing and why, not just sort of the legal basis support. This is I think we were not effective in drawing that Main Street, Wall Street distinction and saying, well, we're really focused on helping out Main Street. And if the financial system collapses, housing prices could fall as they did in Japan, 80 or 90%. We don't want that to happen because that would be devastating for homeowners. But the particular entry points, the particular instruments, as Larry was pointing out, that we're using, were providing support to the financial system supporting the financial system directly. We didn't have the powers to go to the individual homeowners. Mm-hmm. But that distinction wasn't readily apparent. And of course, the Congress was happy to sort of castigate us for not doing that, but they hadn't given the powers to do those sorts of things.
Larry, how much time did you spend meeting with individual lawmakers, if any?
Only when I testified, and mainly screaming at them. The only other time...
But you screaming at them, not them screaming at you.
Yeah. Right. They got used to it. But, the only time was when I was nominated and there were visits to various congressmen. And I could always tell, I could tell who's a Republican and who's a Democrat before I even sat down. And the only one I had a hard time was with Sarbanes, who said, this is what you should do. These are the values you should have. I said, no. I'm a governor. I'm going to do what I think is appropriate. I call it the no looking back rule. You got one shot at me. Okay, nominate me, confirm me, then I'm on my own. In terms of the congressional interaction, the most interesting part were letters we get all the time when there was a possibility we'd raise rates or not lower them, signed by 15 members of Congress. We laughed at that, and we put it in the circular file. Okay. I got only one letter from somebody in the public, and it was in pink, bold letters, and it was entitled, Dear Spawn of Satan. So I said, wait, that's not for me. And I took it to Greenspan.
Sarah.
It's hard to think of the next question.
I don't know what to say to Spawn of Satan. Right? We have to just move on beyond that one. Sarah, one of the theories that you guys come to at the end of the book is that perhaps the Fed becomes more reliant on Congress as they move closer and closer to the zero lower bound, as the Fed sort of runs out of ammunition. Why is that? And is the Fed more, considering where we're at, is the Fed more dependent on Congress today than it has been in previous generations?
Well, I think you put your finger on one of the anomalies here about independence, right, which is, and then we'll come to the question about what happens when you get in a deflationary as opposed to inflationary context, right? All the theories economists give us about why we need independence of central banks is that we fear lawmakers juicing the economy in search of re-election and going too far and fueling inflation. And so we create an independent central bank. Lawmakers dutifully tie their hands, I'm tying my hands behind my back, tie their hands behind their back and then set the goals and let the system run. Well, over 100 years of Fed history, that certainly accounts for the 1970s, but doesn't help us much on other episodes, certainly not the crisis that gave birth to the Fed in 1913, the Great Depression in the 30s, or the most recent one, the financial crisis. So the rationale for independence, it theoretically makes sense for inflationary times, but if for what certainly Ben Bernanke has written about, that in times of deflation, bring in the fiscal cavalry, right? We're waiting for them to come because no legislature, no central bank can do the things one really needs to generate demand to stimulate the economy in a period of deflation. So I'm not surprised.
In order to achieve its goals, the Fed needs Congress more than ever, is what you're saying.
And Janet Yellen, her phrase is typically a healthy mix. We need a healthy mix of monetary and fiscal policy. And of course, the story in the wake, and we show in the book, in the wake of financial crisis is after the initial stimulus, differences of opinion on Capitol Hill, whether for ideological reasons or partisan reasons, ended fiscal stimulus.
Let me just say, fiscal policy and its usefulness to stabilization policy, doing some of the Fed would do, has absolutely nothing to do with Fed independence. You could say that things like helicopter money, which the Fed can't be forced to do, which could be a good idea, and they could cooperate on. Difficult, but you know, I've written it's certainly possible. So fiscal policy is another story. They dreamed of it when they needed it. They're not dreaming of it now when they don't need it. So I don't think that's an issue at all. Does Congress know the difference between coal independence and instrument independence? No, they've known very little about monetary policy. But you have to ask, what do? They set the goals and they give the Fed freedom. But Sarah made a very important point, and you get to the point where you just can't test this. We can't identify particular points where I would say where the Federal Reserve Act was revised or whatever forced the Fed to do something different than it otherwise would do. But you say, well, was it ever an influence? So I would say there's one thing they could have looked at, and that is the very large balance sheet today. There was concern. Republicans hated it. But they did it anyway. But today you have to ask, why would they want to shrink the balance sheet, as Ben has often said? I can't give an economic reason. I could give a political reason and make Congress happier. I think the big story is policy space. They'd rather increase the balance sheet from 3 to 4.5 than from 4.5 to 6. And they're going to have to do asset purchases again. So I think that's a place where there's also the question of what happens if they suffer capital losses, because they're not allowed to register capital losses. All kinds of things like that where politics come into it to a degree, but never in the sense of what should they do with the funds rate, when should they carry out asset purchases.
But the funds rate is not the only important decision that the Fed makes. I mean, Randy, you know, we can think back to 2000, well, you can think back to 2008, you know, when the Fed had already bailed out AIG, right? There's the question about what happens with Lehman Brothers, and I know this has been sort of analyzed ad nauseum, but the Fed's decision not to act, walk us through how much of that, you said it was a legal interpretation, but was that legal interpretation constrained by the political realities that the Fed was kind of already tapped out?
Well, I don't think it was, at least from my perspective, I can't speak for the board members, and you know, Ben is here, so you can bring Ben in to get his views. I don't think it was a view that the Fed was tapped out. I think one, the narrative of the crisis is that somehow that Lehman was the spark. And actually, I think it was much more a symptom rather than the cause. How did we get to this position where all the investment banks were barely able to fund themselves, and one in particular wasn't able to fund itself? We thought we had a merger partner for it. So some people have these conspiracy theories that we had to shoot one of them. That was not, well, again, there are a lot of there may have been a lot of discussions that I wasn't certainly not in every discussion, but I never heard anyone say that that's what we've got to do to sort of prove our mettle, you know, with Congress or with the public. We thought we had a merger partner in Barclays. I mean, this is, you know, well described in like Hank Paulson's book and others. I'm not there's nothing newsworthy here, but we thought we did, and we had a merger partner for Merrill Lynch with Bank of America, and so basically what we needed was a capital infusion. And the Fed is very clearly not able to do a capital infusion. That's very clear. You can provide lending to a solvent institution against good collateral. Now, in the middle of a financial crisis, exactly what constitutes a solvent institution and what constitutes sufficiently good collateral, that's obviously a matter of interpretation. That is not something that is, you know, is completely clear-cut. And some people have argued that Lehman was obviously solvent or obviously insolvent, and we should or shouldn't have acted. We had the legal power to do so. At least from my point of view, again, and I can't say this for anyone else, Lehman was certainly different than Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, because some people said, well, you gave Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley economic charters on an emergency basis, again, exercising our Section 13(3) powers on unusual and pressing circumstances, unusual circumstances, moving to do that. Why didn't you just do that for Lehman and it would have solved the problem? Well, we didn't feel the same comfort with the viability of Lehman's business model. Basically, Lehman had been picked apart for months over that summer. They were much larger than Bear Stearns, but by the time September came around, in many of the interconnected markets, they were actually smaller than they were. And the problem that came up was not in the over-the-counter derivatives markets, which is what we were concerned about with and those interconnected markets with Bear Stearns, but it happened with the money market funds, an interconnection that we didn't fully see, and I think certainly the SEC didn't fully see either. But this was an institution that was much weakened. It wasn't clear it had a viable business model. It wasn't clear how much capital it actually had. At that time, trying to estimate the value of illiquid assets on any institution's balance sheet, you're going to have a fairly wide standard error. And when institutions have 1 to 2% capital, it doesn't take very much of a standard error in the middle of a crisis to think, well, maybe it's solvent or maybe it's not solvent. And so we didn't feel the same level of comfort as we did with Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to be able to provide, say, yes, these institutions have sufficient capital. They have a plan where we feel confident that they would be able to build to our usual capital standards, that they have viable business models. We didn't feel that, or at least I should say I didn't feel that was the case with respect to Lehman Brothers, and that's exactly why we were looking for merger partners. Now, that didn't happen. We couldn't get the effective capital infusion, and as Hank points out in his book, he had been talking with Dick Fuld for a long time. There are a number of people, the Korean Development Bank and others, who wanted to invest, but the problem was it would have been too dilutive of shareholders like Dick Fuld, who said, no, I'm not going to take $4 a share. When I got my $1 billion stock grant a year ago, it was over $100 a share. So this isn't right. You know, our argument, of course, was $4 is better than zero. And that, I think, was the right argument ultimately, but not a very effective argument at that time. And so I think we felt that Lehman was a different case. It would have been both in a narrow sense beyond our powers because we couldn't do the capital infusion. That's what you needed. But we were looking for that through the mergers, just like JPM Morgan Chase being the merger partner for Bear Stearns was effectively a capital infusion, but a private sector capital infusion.
So let me just say, Randy, that's a great and clear discussion of the Lehman decision. That was, should we or shouldn't we? But the question here really goes to, should the Fed have that power or shouldn't it? They had that power. They exercised it. But it's a legitimate question for Congress whether or not they should let the central bank intervene in individual institutions. Now, as Ben said, well, he's happy they took that away. And I would have been too. It makes the economy more susceptible to crises, I will admit. But there are some things that should be a central bank's in power, and that's one of them that I don't think. So that's a political issue. and Sarah and Mark talk about it as clipping the Fed's wings, and I think you could argue that that's the case, but I think that was legitimate for Congress to say, should that be in there or shouldn't that be in there?
Sarah?
Well, so it does raise the question of whether 13.3, the special emergency lendings, are goals or tools, and I think we agree that they're tools. The other changes to 13.3 in light of the performance of the Fed, as Randy said, it's not that they didn't think they were stepping over the line. You said Congress didn't like the way they were using it. The other result was now the Fed, the Board of Governors, in using 13.3, has to get sign-off from the Secretary of the Treasury. That doesn't sound like clear independence to me. So I just think that there's lines here between sort of sheer versions of independence and the ways in which politics and congressional politics can come to have some pressure on the use of these tools. And I agree with Larry completely, and I know Mark and I have struggled with, is what's the counterfactual, right? What would have happened in the absence of a world without Congress? But we do see what happens when the Congress uses the tool, and regardless of how it was used, it was clipped back. So we see evidence here that we can connect the use of the tools to paying a cost for not heeding those political signals that they may have been hearing, for better or for worse.
Another point of leverage that Congress, or at least the Senate, has in shaping the Fed's decision-making process is deciding who sits on the Fed's Board of Governors. Randy, I believe your renomination was blocked by Democrats, and that could have shaped the makeup of the board and then perhaps the decisions the board made in the future. I remember covering Janet Yellen's nomination, and at that time, that was said to be one of the most politicized Fed nomination battles in modern history. Certainly, we may have been on a different monetary policy course had Larry Summers become Fed chair, judging by his subsequent comments. I'd like to hear you all talk a little bit about, has the role of the Fed and the positions on the Fed's board become overly politicized in today's environment?
This is a sanctioned political role of the president. He is required to do that. And of course, Democrats pick Democrats, Republicans pick Republicans. They have different views of monetary policy. So an interesting book would be to see how different one presidential set of appointments was in changing the course of monetary policy. I'm sure we could show that. But that's the way the law is set up. That is, the political independence of the Fed is mostly about interference by presidents. Nixon and Burns successfully, Volcker and LBJ unsuccessfully. That's where I think the real pressure is on the Fed with respect to policy, with respect to instruments, and what they should do. So it's just the way it is.
Sarah, is this an example of political interdependence being baked into the design of the Fed?
Well, for sure, and it's not been constant over time, right? Congress is, in fact, watching Nixon and Burns in the 70s had a solution to that, which is to require the chair to come before Congress for a confirmation vote, right? I never had to do that before. I think it's pretty clear lawmakers themselves in those debates said, who's the boss, right? We have others, right, lawmakers saying these on the floor of the Senate. So clearly, I think Congress sees these as an avenue for exerting at least direction to the Fed. They try to exploit it. And just quickly on the confirmation process, right, we've had for over the course of the Obama Fed and now into the Trump Fed, right, vacancies. Right, that's the way politics plays out. And you'd obviously better than me to say what difference does it make for the making of all the work of the board to have three, four, maybe potentially five seats vacant.
And so I've been unanimously confirmed twice before the renomination. So I don't think it was sort of a broader political thing that was going on. And so I do think that there has been a bit of a change in that, because now, so like President Bush nominated a number of people who I don't believe were Republicans. Actually, like, I don't know Don Cohn's political affiliation, even though I was there. I never talked to him about it, but my hunch is he's probably more likely, if he is registered as a party, probably more likely as a Democrat than a Republican, but it never came up. But he had no hesitation to, the president had no hesitation to do that. But it does seem now that there tends to be more pairing of, and that would, I think, be a very interesting thing to look at to try to get at this issue. It used to be just, you know, when people would come up, but now there seems to be a few positions open. There'll be a pairing of someone who would be more appealing to Republicans and someone who would be more appealing to Democrats. That's traditionally how many of the other agencies, like the SEC, which is very clear. The chair is from the president's party, and then you get two from one side, two from the other side. And I think traditionally that wasn't how appointments were typically made to the Fed, but I think more recently there's been more of that, well, you know, pairing. There's always been some of that's been done, so I don't want to say that this is something that's new and it was only started in 2008, but I think it's become a little bit more standard to have that, and so I think that is politicizing the process a bit more.
Though it seems like this time around the process is completely different than it has been in the past. President Trump, I believe it was just yesterday, was up for lunch on Capitol Hill, meeting with Republican senators, and asked them for a show of hands of who their favorite Fed chair nominee might be. Apparently it was Taylor versus Powell, and Yellen was mentioned. What does this do to the environment, the political environment surrounding the Fed, and to that eventual nominee's political capital?
Well, it's the name of the game. What you have to ask is this: whoever.
But this is Stan. This is okay.
It's what it is. It's what it is. It's the Federal Reserve Act. Okay, the one political interference, if you like, is the president's ability to nominate and Congress to confirm. Okay, so that's the way it is. It's a very important one, no question about it. The question you have to ask is this: if the president picks John Taylor instead of Janet Yellen, would the president have more political influence over the Fed than otherwise?
You mentioned Burns, who is the sort of iconic example where the president and his loyalty pledge for his Fed chair. I was going to say one other thing. I touched on it briefly in my introduction, but the learning for Sarah and me in studying the history of our central bank was a Federal Reserve. And I think I've learned all of my political science from Sarah, and the United States is infused with these weird institutions. And I think our central bank, the Fed, is absolutely one of them. I mean, we're touching on the presidential nominees and the congressional or Senate confirmation process, but you also have a dozen essentially private sector employees, presidents of the district banks. We write in the book, moored in the same cities they were way back in 1913, who have an important vote on our monetary policy. And so it's not just the sort of president's political prerogative. It certainly is. It's not a now, Sarah, correct us if we're wrong, a sort of very low bar to get that confirmation without a filibuster-less confirmation process. But Congress is deciding who gets to vote. It's not just simply sort of deigned by the president's appointment. They could wake up and decide they want the presidents of the district banks from the shires to have a bigger voice. To the extent they fail to fill those chairs, that gives the districts a little bit more weight. So, if we took nothing away from this exploration of the myth of independence, it's this very weird federal structure to our central bank.
And if I could just add one thing on that. And when you're in the boardroom, it's a very, very large room because everyone has to sit around the table, and there are many staff members, some of whom are here, who sit around there. On the east side of the room is an enormous map that is probably 30 feet across and 15 or 20 feet high of the United States with all the districts in it. So when you are meeting, you are reminded that this is a federal system and that it represents all the districts of the United States. I don't know how many people actually did look at the map during the meetings, but it's there as a reminder. I don't think it was an accident that they happened to put that so prominently on one of the walls. And the building was, it's interesting, because the building was built in the 30s. So it was just as all these reforms were taking place, but it still was seen as very important to have that up there.
But one point that you make in the book and that you brought up, Mark, during your earlier remarks, is that one of the ways that Congress has tried to increase its leverage over the Fed is by trying to consolidate that power within the Board of Governors here in Washington. So, you know, where are we in that pendulum, and which way is that pendulum continuing to swing?
So I think in all of the revisions, a dozen and a half to the act that we looked at, they seemed more and more to concentrate power in the D.C.-based Board of Governors. They haven't removed the votes of a rotating set of district banks, but in terms of, you know, back in the sort of original recipe, each individual district could make its own monetary policy. So we've certainly come a long way in 100 years. I think when we've thought about the more contemporary reform bills that are sort of ping-ponging around Capitol Hill, in many ways they would represent, not that we think they have a strong chance of passing, but they would represent maybe the first bit of legislation that would try to devolve power back to the district. So we may have gone as far in the centralization. I think the first or second paper that we wrote, which formed part of the book, was called Decentral Banking. And I think we've probably reached the limit of what this particular legislature would tolerate in terms of power in the Board of Governors.
And Sarah, I think this maybe speaks to some of the points that Larry has been making. What is wrong? Is there a problem with having an interdependent central bank in Congress?
Oh, I don't think we
reach. Is there anything wrong?
That's a great question. I don't think we reach any normative conclusions about what an ideal relationship would be. And if anything, living in a obviously democratic system, having a somewhat independent Fed, having it be responsive to democratic pressures is what we would expect, right? And that interdependence, I think, is one of the ways in which public pressures come to bear and get expressed on the Fed. And so in that sense, I think it's kind of a healthy way to think about the relationship. That's like the positive spin, or the negative spin is, oh, this is just politics interfering with experts. But I think there's some broad reason why we might want legislative influence over the...
But I think Randy and Larry and Elon, you asked the question. The notion of central bank independence typically is to temper sort of inflationary bias. And I think where we may see some problems, and I sort of take Larry's and Randy's experience sort of very, very intimately, but when the legislature is more hawkish than sitting members of the central bank, when they are, through threats, maybe sort of subtlety around the edges, checking your ability to build the balance sheet, your ability to exercise lender of last resort power, your ability to live comfortably at the zero bound or lower, I think you do open up a potential problem in wrestling with another crisis, should we be so unfortunate as to face one. Would they be so willing to build that balance?
That is really interesting. I think a full chapter on these are the greatest threats to Fed independence, to instrument independence, that we have seen in the reform proposals. And just to show you the politics, some of them want all presidents to have votes, not just five. Why do the Republicans support that? Because presidents are more hawkish on average. I mean, you know, so that's the kind of political influence. That's where they have that ability to change that structure. The structure was, and it's really interesting, the governors are supposed to outnumber the presidents on the FOMC. And governors live in the same place, they live in the same neighborhood, and rarely it's happened.
Capitol Hill versus Northwest.
They act as a block. But what happens when you only have three governors? That's not what the founding fathers wanted, and that creates some issues. But I would say, I never said this before. Thank God for the president. I've never said that before, because they're the bulwark for independence of the Fed and for continuity in policy. So, go to it.
I'd like to open it up for questions from the audience. I think there's a mic going around and right here.
My question is for Sarah. You've written about attempts in the past to subject some aspect of the Fed to audit by the Government Accountability Office. I think you concluded it's neither feasible nor desirable. Could you just elaborate on that?
Sure. So audit the Fed, the idea that Congress would direct the government, these days the Accountability Office, to in some form audit what's going on, whether it is the books, which they do now, or whether it's to be in the Monetary Policy Committee or to review it right afterwards. All right, these are efforts by Congress to impose more transparency on the Fed. We talk about it as a sort of a creature of Rand Paul and Ron Paul, but it's really the godchild of Wright Patton from the 1950s. These were populist Democrats who didn't like what the Fed was doing and put pressure on the Fed by introducing audits. That took 20 years. They got it, an audit, but carved out the monetary policy exception. Those pressures continue. They continue through Volcker. They continue all the way up till today. Mm-hmm. There's been strong Republican support for it. There's been some Democratic support, depending on whether you're up for re-election and or come from more moderate background. So I would never say it can't happen. I would observe that the audit bills, my senses have stepped back a little bit. They're a little less intrusive than some of the Ron Paul versions of it. I would just observe the Fed has pretty routinely fought new measures of transparency, and so they fight this one as well. The question is whether the types of GAO and audits envisioned, would that hamper the writing of making of monetary policy?
Let me just note that the transparency is an interesting issue. The Fed has fought every attempt by Congress to impose more transparency, but has gone along with it in the end and found out that it's made monetary policy more effective, not less effective. And the GAO is interesting. It's an interesting question. What would happen if there was a GAO audit? Would that affect decisions, or would it just be a bloody pain in the neck?
All the way in the back.
I'm Susan Irving, and I work at GAO.
Would they be a pain in the neck, Susan?
I actually do the lead the work on debt management, and every time we go to the New York Fed or the board, we make clear that we're there to talk to them as their fiscal agent for the Treasury, and we're actually pretty supportive of the ban on us auditing monetary policy. We have neither the competence nor the interest in acquiring the competence to do so. It was of some concern, I think, to a number of us when there was a proposal to move the auto bailout management to the Fed, because the more you give things not related to economic stability to the Fed, the more pressure there is to bring in people like us. But actually, before the question, I wanted to raise the point that in some sense, the insight of an independence is not new. I mean, with all due respect, some of us have known for years that there's no such thing as an independent blank. The Constitution set up three branches of government, and neither the FCC nor the SEC nor any of them are, in fact, independent agencies. But I think of them in a way if you think of game theory and stuff, as a way for the Congress to seek to protect itself or stop itself from doing things it has the absolute power to do but thinks it should not do. And I mean, I'm old enough to have handled Lyle Gramley's confirmation for the Fed. And clearly, you know, Congress could have set monetary policy anytime it wanted, but it didn't want to do it. So it blamed the Fed. And so I haven't read the book, but it seems to me that, in fact, both of you may be right. There's Larry's view that the strength given to our country and our credibility, despite efforts to come off of close to default, by an independent central bank, is very important, while we at the same time recognize that Congress could take it back anytime it wanted, because you're really subservient to the Congress.
And behind you by the wall.
Thanks so much for the book. I'm Sam Bell. I'm a consultant. I'm wondering whether any of you thinks the maximum employment mandate gets in the way of Fed independence. And I ask because John Taylor in 2012 wrote a book called First Principles, in which he said we should have a single mandate, price stability. One of his arguments was it will enhance independence of the central bank, focus, an easier job, all of that. So I'm curious whether the dual mandate, I know there are 3 minutes, but the dual mandate gets in the way of independence.
No, this is Congress's job to give the Fed mandates. They've given them intelligent mandates, but the Fed is unique, almost unique among central banks, of having a dual mandate. Other central banks pretty much act that way, but typically have either a price stability objective or some hierarchical system. So the Fed is unique, but and some people like Taylor would prefer just to have an inflation objective. That's fine. Congress could do that, okay, at its peril.
Sorry, Randy.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, because studies have been done in practice looking at different mandates across different central banks have, some of them closer to being dual mandates, some of them closer to being sort of a very narrow focus on inflation. And exactly as Larry had said, in practice, if we look over the last 25 to 30 years as central banks have been adopting these sorts of explicit mandates, it doesn't seem, you couldn't really predict different actions based on the mandate. In practice, central banks seem to be operating in roughly the same way, regardless of what the formal mandate is, because even if it is just a very narrow focus on inflation, it's very hard to ignore if Paris is burning, for example. And so the ECB has a relatively narrow mandate, but they, you know, Mario Draghi does not ignore when the unemployment rate is extremely high, when the, you know, the economy is not doing well in the Eurozone, and quite reasonably. And also economics allows you to bring the two together. So even if you don't have some explicit mandate for looking at employment, you can focus on your inflation goal and say, but employment or growth or some of these other factors will be affecting where the trajectory of inflation. And so we are consistent with our particular mandate. But since these other pieces come in and our broader economic understanding of the interconnections in the and the way the economy works, that's you're going to be taking those into account. And I think that's why in practice you typically do see them act in the same way, roughly the same way, even with different mandates.
Except does that change when in situations like now we're facing both low unemployment and low inflation, and depending on what your mandate might be, you know, your choice of which side to focus on might be different?
I think I would say that the ECB and the Fed have acted in sort of broadly, not exactly, but broadly similar ways in response to somewhat different shocks. But, you know, the shocks came later in Europe, but then, you know, the ECB has done exactly what the Fed did of buying assets, bringing interest rates down. They've actually brought them down to negative territory using very explicit forward guidance. I sometimes call that open mouth operations rather than open market operations. And, you know, Mario Draghi understood the importance of that when he said, you know, we will do whatever it takes, and believe you me, it will be enough. That had an enormous impact on the markets, much more of an impact than announcement of any particular asset purchase or any particular move in interest rates. And so I think even in those these tough circumstances, it's roughly the same. Is it exactly the same? Probably not. But, you know, but I think roughly the central banks seem to be acting, responding to the same kinds of ways, using the same kinds of tools in response to the same kinds of shocks.
In the front.
Hi, Victoria Guida with Politico. I wanted to ask, what this means in terms of how the Fed should act toward Congress. You know, the Fed, in my experience, has been always very hesitant to speak out publicly. During speeches, they'll make sort of oblique references to proposals in Congress, but, they try to avoid being sort of overtly political. So I was just kind of wondering, I mean, do you think that the Fed should be more active, more public about its, positions? Is it all just about, you know, making sure that you talk to Congress all the time and having good relationships with them? What should the Fed be doing better in terms of its relationship with Congress?
Well, it's a really interesting question. Let me say this. When you say its view, it doesn't have a view. There are different members. They all have different views. Okay. A chairman is the one who has the opportunity, and some more than others. I have a strong view that because they have that bully pulpit, chairmen should support the overwhelming wisdom of the economics profession, whether it's about deficits or limited impacts of taxes on supply side, but never something that was more overtly political. And, how should they act? The answer is respectfully.
I agree.
Another question in the front here.
Thank you. I'm Edward Cowan. I'm a retired New York Times economics correspondent. And I have a question which I want to direct primarily to the authors. You have taken a deep dive into the history of the Fed going back to the enabling legislation. So let me ask the question about the history of the notion of independence. Did the notion of independence essentially take root and get much more emphasis, and you might tell us where, after the Accord of 1951, which freed the Fed from supporting the Treasury market? Or did it really antedate that? And if so, what's the evidence?
So that's a great question. And I think what struck us possibly most was how little attention is paid to this concept of independence beyond the structural features that are built into the Federal Reserve, right? The fact that there's no appropriation for the Fed, even in the early versions, long terms, right before the 35 revisions, long terms, general ways in which, and having, of course, a decentralized, right? Having privately selected, essentially bankers having running their own monetary policy. So there's very little attention beyond those structural features to any type of really autonomy of the Fed, right? They're always coming in and constantly, certainly in the 1930s, after just 20 years on the job, basically they rip up the Federal Reserve Act and start again. For the Fed-Treasury Accord, and just one note, of the 30s, Much of the power of monetary policy was not given back to the Fed when they rewrote it. They gave it to Treasury, some checks on Congress's on the Fed's ability to do monetary policy. Gave it to the president to set basically gold prices, and Treasury to the exchange stabilization fund.
There was that exchange stabilization fund, which Morgenthau sort of conjured up. I think we touch on it in the book as a sort of possible sort of balance to the balance sheet.
Into and out of World War II. There is no independence. It was subordination to Treasury. Treasury, the Accord in 1951, we do a kind of deep dive to look at it, and we argue that rather than a handshake between Fed and Treasury, so Fed had been pegging the very low rates, eventually causing inflation in the early 50s, the conventional wisdom is the Fed and Treasury shake hands, they have an accord, Treasury says, okay, you can get power back over your rate setting, and the Fed has really claimed this to be the source of Fed independence. When you dig down deeper, you realize, where's Congress? Well, they played a role in tilting the power to the Fed, making Treasury and the president step down. And as we argue in the book, they end up freed, yes, absolutely independent of Treasury, but now subservient to the congressional boss. Right, and Congress had its own reasons for doing that as well that we go into in the book. And the Fed, I think, benefited from it as well, but we certainly don't see, we see that accord as a divorce with Treasury, and we see the Fed being pulled back stronger to Congress.
Question here in the middle.
Hi, I'm Richard Skinner at Johns Hopkins University, and this question is particularly for Sarah because you're the Congress wonk on the panel. We've heard a lot about how the Federal Reserve perceives Congress, but could you talk a little bit more about how Congress perceives the Federal Reserve, particularly the roles of the two committees, two relevant committees, Senate Banking and House Financial Services, and note how, you know, the Federal Reserve is pretty different from the usual departments and agencies that Congress oversees.
Well, it's a good question, and certainly the lack of needing appropriations from the Congress changes to some extent that dynamic, right? I think I would say that members of Congress in the House and Senate, there's a pretty uneven attention to the Fed and to monetary policy, and there are some who do quite take the monetary policy quite seriously and put effort into it. Others, they do show up and ask the questions twice a year. So, but I think members, and you got a very good taste of the chairman of the Financial Services Committee, very clear how he thinks the Fed should be proceeding. There are other clips in that July hearing that I think were pretty illuminating about the size of the balance sheet, praising the Fed for drawing it down. That was quite interesting. There was a discussion we call it the rules box. New this year, the Fed, the board, in presenting their policy report to Congress, put in a box that it compared Taylor 1, Taylor 2, I think 7 different rules and what the outcomes would be. Put it in the box. Congress has been demanding, Republicans in Congress have been demanding more rule-based behavior, less discretion. And here was the Fed understanding, I believe, threats from Congress that they certainly didn't want to be told to follow a rule. I think that we see members do care quite a bit, and as they should, given their electoral implications from the state of the economy.
A question all the way in the back over here.
Bert Ely, banking consultant. If John Taylor is nominated and confirmed as chairman of the Fed, and he is successful in implementing the Taylor rule at the Fed, and let's say that it actually looks like it is going to be successful, that putting monetary policy on kind of autopilot, in fact, produces good results over the long term, what would that effect have? What would that consequence have on the independence of the Fed and of its decision-making authority?
So we've really struggled to understand this idea of appointing a less discretionary, in this case as you've described it, and I think temporally the rule would indicate a more hawkish Federal Reserve, a more hawkish governor. And I think as we've explored it in a sort of contemporizing our thesis, it would certainly sort of dilute some of this independence even further. It would give more power to individuals in Congress, members in the House and Senate, who want to take that discretion away, who just don't think that that the kind of unconventional and creative policies that I think Larry and Randy developed and saw firsthand have a place in this kind of central banking. So, you know, whether we get there immediately, whether there would be maybe a revisionist history to some of his writings or a sort of market forgetting that they were there and just imagine that there are no atheists in the foxhole, that if there is a crisis, he'd do all the kinds of unconventional policies. But I think I'd be a little concerned because of this dilution in independence that the central bank in that environment would be able to do what it has done previously.
Thank you. Hans Roger Bébé, a question for Professor Krosner. The explanation the Fed has given for not providing the support to Lehman Brothers is utterly unconvincing. And I say so because of the fact that, after all, overnight, the institution transformed investment banks into commercial banks. Given what you know today, and I'm asking the question to one of the best economic historians, what do you think the absence of a backstop to Barclays, to some extent, if you know, there is any, the role it played? Because Alistair Darling actually argued that if the Americans really believe that Lehman is a fantastic institution, why don't they provide the same support which was provided, you know, to J.P. Morgan as a backstop for bears?
Well, as I described, I think I was quite explicit on this, that we were much more concerned about the viability of Lehman Brothers than the other institutions, that the business model was much more impaired at Lehman than it was at Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs. Everyone was facing difficulty of getting external funding, and that was true particularly for the investment banks, but even commercial banks were facing those kinds of things. And as I said, I think it was much more a symptom. Actually, if you look back to see at the risk spreads, where the risk spreads go up, what's very interesting is the risk spreads start to explode right after the Treasury intervention for Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And this is one of these paradoxes of power. The same kind of thing happened in the UK when Mervyn King announced that they had provided support for Northern Rock, the first bank in a century that had gotten had a bank run. So you might have thought, the central bank has come in to save the day. It was exactly the opposite. Who is that guy? Why is he talking about my bank? I want my money out. And so, and the same kind of thing happened after Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Oh my goodness, this problem is a lot bigger than I had realized. You know, sort of, and again, gets to this sort of aficionados thing. Aficionados knew and were very worried about these things. The broader public wasn't as focused on this, but suddenly there was this, you know, this bazooka that had been given to Secretary Paulson. He said he wouldn't have to pull the trigger. He pulled the trigger. And people were saying, well, my goodness, what if we start applying these marks to commercial banks or other institutions? You know, would they be solvent or not? And so as I said, I think it's much more sort of symptom rather than cause. I do think that there was a lot going on that week because we were dealing with those. You know, these were institutions that the Fed did not supervise because they were supervised by the SEC, but we were being called in to deal with them because they're obviously a part of the interconnected financial system. And then we came to realize that another institution that we didn't supervise, AIG, was causing potentially even a greater problem with their interconnections in the market. I mentioned Lehman Brothers because people didn't want to be their counterparty, so even though they were larger than, or it started off larger than Bear Stearns, that issue of sort of the counterparty interconnections wasn't quite as big with Lehman because by the time September came around, there weren't many there. AIG, we discovered rapidly, was much bigger issue. And so I think to some extent it was a bandwidth thing that we thought we had a likely merger partner with Barclays, and I think we weren't talking with our counterparts in the UK as much as we should have. I was certainly getting some feedback as the week was going that people seemed in the UK, my counterparts in the UK, seemed to be less enthusiastic about supporting the transaction. And it much like, you know, the transactions that we did in the U.S. with like J.P. Morgan Chase and Bear Stearns, we had to have a memorandum that explained how they could, you know, meet the capital requirements, so they could do these things. So they needed the equivalent on the UK side, and there was something with their company law that in order for Barclays to actually do the takeover and immediately be the backstop behind the debt, would have required a vote, and so they weren't willing to suspend that rule. We hadn't focused enough on that to understand how difficult that was going to be for them to suspend that. And so it would have been better if there had been more opportunities for thinking about other capital. But that was one of the reasons why there was the push for the TARP legislation, because there was no way to do a capital infusion, and we had no there was no way to convince Dick Full that $4 was actually a good thing to do and was good for the system. We had no opportunity to do that. Now that the Treasury Department, in consultation with the Fed, can declare an institution troubled and put it into receivership, that's a very different situation than we were in at that time.
I think we're out of time. I want to thank everybody for coming. Please join me in thanking Sarah and Mark.